Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone. This is Live Event. In the dead of night, when thy winter wounds shall not be healed from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone, and you sit huddled by the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight? The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or hosts. We remind all of our listeners, KV at MTOR, ladies and gentlemen, your host calling not. Tonight, in the Night Zone, we examine recent events involving the sun and tantalizing results of long-range detection of other planets. Solar flares and the universe with Dr. Ian O'Neill. Tonight, in the shadows of the Night Zone.
We interrupt our program. Thank you. This is Washington.
I have just returned from the White House. The United States...
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you...
There's not much question at all what there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com. Your host, Colin Knight.
And you are indeed not alone out in the universe. At least you're in the Night Zone universe tonight. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madame and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of the Night Zone Radio. For those of you listening live, remember, if you sign into blogtalkradio.com and come to the Night Zone show page, you can also participate in the virtual studio tech show while listening to the show down in the virtual studio. And remember, we ask that if you listen to a show at a later time or even live, please take a moment to rate the show after you've heard it. It goes a long way to letting everybody know what kind of content we carried tonight. Tonight, an old friend is back with us, Dr. Ian O'Neill, a solar physicist, author, and space science producer for the Discovery News. Ian, welcome back to the Night Zone, sir.
Hello, Colin. It's been too long.
It has been a long time. It has been a long time. And as you reminded me just before the show, the Night Zone was the first radio show you did on Blog Talk, and it catapulted from there.
It was my first radio interview full stop, actually. I think it was back in 2008. And, of course, yeah, it was all on the 2012 Mayan calendar. And, first of many, as it turned out.
Good Lord. Well, I'm glad things worked out for you. And your good wife, Deborah, as well, I take it?
She's very good. Yeah, we're happily married now. I don't know if we were married when we were talking last time. Yeah, we probably just got married. Happy in California.
Well, how can you not be happy in California? They tell me it's the land of plenty. So, you know, you guys, although you guys have some political upheaval down there, I don't know how Schwarzenegger is going to get himself out of this financial grab. But that's for another show, probably.
Yeah.
We talked shortly after the August 1st solar events. What exactly was happening at that time, Ian? We got the general mainstream media gist of it, but was this expected or did this come right out of the blue?
A bit of both. We're kind of expecting the solar cycle to be picking up. So we were going to have, you know, increase in magnetic activity on the surface of the sun. And, of course, that's going to peak at around about 2013. But it's ramping up now. You're getting lots more sunspots. It's all very exciting on the solar surface. But the flare that in question that was spotted by the Solar Dynamics Observatory on the surface of the sun that wasn't expected. I mean, you can't really predict when flares are going to happen. It was in a predicted region. It was like an active region on the surface of the sun. But you can't predict solar flares. You don't know when they're going to fire something at you. And it just so happened that this was a phenomenal event because it was captured by several different observatories and it was tracked as the coronal mass ejection that was generated by this event traveled towards the Earth. And then, of course, it hit us as predicted. And that's very, very exciting for solar physics in general.
Because it gives us some kind of warning or... because it's the first time we've ever been able to predict a solar interruption, so to speak.
Kind of, yeah. And really, these kind of events that really get solar physicists very, very excited, because you can actually see a feature on the surface of the sun evolve into something that's going to hit us. And, of course, that generated a solar storm in the upper atmosphere of the Earth, which is phenomenal, because that really does help us predict them in the future. And, of course, we've got such great observatories now that can actually look at the surface of the sun in such high definition. And then actually tracking the thing as it comes towards us, estimating the speed that it's traveling, and actually within a couple of hours predict when it's going to hit us. So, yeah, it was awesome. I mean, my solar physics background, of course, that got me really excited. So I was following it intently. It's great being a space producer now, because I'm able to produce articles along these lines and really communicate solar physics. It's really good.
Well, I have to tell you, as soon as it happened, the first web page I went to was Astro Engine, and then from there, of course, I went over to Discovery, because that's where the information is. If you want to hear anything, all of our people out there, if you definitely want to grab some proper knowledge. Now, this is knowledge that's not scientific mumbo jumbo that you can't get your head around. That's what I like about your site, Ian, is it, you know, it should be called Science for Dummies, right, Colin? You know, that's what it should be called, because the way you explain it, it comes clear to me, and I appreciate that. Now, this CMA that happened, did it have the ability to do major damage to our systems on Earth, or did we know when it happened that it was not going to be that type of a solar attack?
Yeah, we knew that the solar flare that occurred on the surface of the sun, that was actually an M-class flare, which is a below-average flare. It's certainly nothing to write home about. But the reason, as I said, the reason why it's so exciting, because we connect that to the events that happened on the Earth. But the coronal mass ejection that was generated wasn't predicted to be that big. It wasn't traveling as fast as, say, some of the bigger coronal mass ejections. If you have a very big one, a big bubble of magnetic energy being blasted out into space by a huge solar event, and that usually happens more towards solar maximum in a few years' time. This one was mediocre, but we could track it. We actually saw it. And we, as I said, we were able to track how fast it was going. We kind of knew the impact that it could have on Earth. Again, we don't know exactly what will happen when it hits us, because it depends on the magnetic alignment of the Earth's magnetosphere and the magnetic alignment of this coronal mass ejection, this magnetic bubble. Right. But if the conditions are right, they can connect and they can inject this bubble of plasma, these energetic particles directly from the sun. They can be injected into our magnetosphere, and they funnel around into the polar regions and generate massive aurora. So we had a high alert was put out generally by the NOAA. They put a solar storm warning up, but they weren't expecting anything major. As it turned out, it was a medium geomagnetic storm, and that's quite noteworthy. I mean, it could cause low-level communication problems, and it did produce some fairly spectacular aurora, but it's not the kind of thing that could cause blackout events or not necessarily knock satellites out of orbit, but that's very unpredictable in itself. But it's just about preparation, and that is the key thing. We knew this thing was coming. It was like a test run, if you like, and I think we were very well prepared, and I'm sure all the government agencies were very aware of this thing happening, even though they weren't expecting anything too big.
Right. Now, if this obviously wasn't big enough to of major consequence, but this would be the same type of mechanism, for a lack of a better word, that the sun would use to fire something pretty nasty at us. It would be the same kind of belching kind of mass, am I correct?
Absolutely, yeah. And really, when I talk about, and this is, as you were saying, about mainstream media, you get a general gist as to what's going on, and often they interchange a coronal mass ejection and a solar flare. And these two are very, very different animals, and they're often connected, but they don't always have to be. So a coronal mass ejection could be generated without solar flare, and not every solar flare is going to generate a coronal mass ejection. The flare is literally on the surface of the sun where it kind of flashes, produces radiation, and that hits us instantly because it travels at the speed of light. So that's when we see, it's almost like a gun firing. And in this case, the gun was pointed right at us. So when the gun fired, we saw the flare, like the muzzle shot, and then it was just by pure coincidence it also produced, it had a big magnetic structure around it, and it got unleashed, and it basically erupted and produced this coronal mass ejection. And sure enough, yeah, this the same kind of mechanism that we'd expect if we did have a big flaring event. And really the last really big flaring event that did cause lots of damage on the ground, the one that actually caused some really tangible evidence for damage on the surface was the Carrington event, and that was in the mid-18th century. And that actually generated an electric current through the atmosphere that was so powerful that it overloaded telegraph lines. Now, wow. If you think that if that could happen now, just look at how many cables. I mean, I'm looking at my window now, and I can see a whole network of cables. So, and this is just generating, just increasing the charge on these lines, and they overload, and they can spark, and they can catch fire, and, you know, you can have problems with national grids. And that actually happened, was about 10, 15 years ago in Quebec, in Canada, yeah. when a fairly large CME did hit Earth, and it knocked out their electrical system for a short time. So again, these are all warning signs. We know these are things that have happened in the past. We know around the time when these coronal mass ejections can happen, when the sun's increasing in magnetic activity. And so now we are getting very advanced in our knowledge, and we need to understand how to predict these things more accurately.
And now that we have spotted this ejection and tracked it to Earth, has it given us any more information about a possible forewarning system? Is there anything on the horizon for that?
Well, there is already quite an effective warning system we've got in place, because for a start, we've got various satellites in Earth orbit. We've got solar observatories that are constantly looking at the sun. The most recent one that was launched at the end of last year, and it went online earlier this year, is the Solar Dynamics Observatory, and that is the most exciting solar experiment for many years, because it can view the sun in high definition, which is far higher than any kind of TV you can buy on the market. So this thing is incredibly high-tech, and it can take in the whole of the disk of the sun. It can monitor it for any magnetic disturbances. So we get that warning. So that's a very advanced warning when we see something happen on the surface of the sun. But we also have the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, which is based in the first Lagrangian point, which is a point where gravity balances out between the Earth and the sun. So it's constantly between us and the sun. So it's almost like a sentry, really. It just sort of sits there. It's also observing the sun, but it's also got some particle detectors on it. And also there is the solar wind experiment. It's called ACE, and that's in the same location. It's sitting in the solar wind stream, so it detects all these high-energy particles. And both these experiments can detect when a coronal mass ejection is coming in directly in our direction. And then, of course, in Earth orbit, we've got various environmental satellites that detect X-ray flares from the sun, and they can also detect these highly energetic particles as they impact our atmosphere. So we've got a whole suite of missions now that are able to track quite far out, and we're getting better at it. But of course, solar physics is an underfunded field, so we kind of need more investment, and we need more missions like this. The more missions, the better, as far when it comes to the sun, because it can throw something at us, and we're just not prepared. But as I said, you know, the previous CME was a good example because we're able to track it. So we are getting better, but we need more funding.
Right. Now, of course, with NASA cutting back on the space program and they shutting down the shuttle service and the space station having obviously a finite life left, once it's built, I think it only has about 15 years, I think, is the lifespan once it's completed. So we need to get back up there. We need to have some observatories that can help us with these CMEs, I think, because it certainly seems like out of all of the things that we could be worried about on Earth, it could be over in a blink of an eye from something that we barely explored.
Absolutely. And the thing is, NASA, although they've been making cutbacks, especially in the human spaceflight area, there's been a lot of investment in robotic missions. And there is, although, as I say, it is an underfunded field, there are a lot of missions involved with solar physics. And there will be more on the horizon. So I don't think we have to worry too much about the NASA cutbacks. We just need to make the NASA top brass aware that this is a very important thing to be doing, because as one of my friends said, one of my solar physics friends, Alex Young, he I actually did the Discovery Channel documentary about 2012 with him, and we were the solar physics experts on there, and he was saying the sun has no regard for life on Earth. And if it throws something at us, it's going to be completely random. It doesn't aim stuff at us. It's got no idea we're here, which is part of the problem. So it's like, this thing could just send something very big our way, and it could knock out satellites. It could endanger astronauts if we're not fully prepared, and it can have tangible effects on the planet's surface as well. And some of them could be quite extreme.
Right. Now, I have a question down in the virtual studio regarding the sun's great conveyor belt. Apparently, it's reporting that it's traveling at a very slow rate. Has it sped up or slowed down since this belch? And does the sun's conveyor belt activity affect a solar flare production?
It does, and we're only really just developing our understanding. I mean, this is how recent this study is being put together, because when I was in solar physics, I didn't really know an awful lot about the conveyor belt. I mean, I don't know an awful lot now, and there's a lot more experts out there that know about this. But there is this slow convection within the sun where these magnetic field lines are pushed up to the surface and they get pulled back down again. It's a very dynamic system. And there is some evidence to suggest that it's slowed down. That could have explained why we had such a very, very low and inactive solar minimum. But then again, we're talking about massive timescales here. I mean, we have an 11-year solar cycle where the magnetic poles of the sun flip. So they flip once in 11 years and then flip again another 11 years. So you actually have a 22-year cycle. And there's also other cycles. If you look at the long-term period of all these smaller cycles, they can be grouped together in longer period cycles. And these longer periods are perhaps linked to this conveyor belt. And I just think it's poorly understood at the moment. And I'm sure there's more detail you can find from an expert in that field. But yeah, there is definitely something going on. There's something that affects the sun for longer periods than the 11-year cycle than what we're seeing.
Okay. And another question down in virtual studio from Luis. Ian, when we see an image or a flare from the SDO, can we tell if it's aimed towards Earth?
Well, when you see a flare, you're actually looking at it's got several filters. This instrument. This has got a camera with loads of different filters, and it's able to see plasma in different temperatures. If you look at lower temperatures, you're looking actually at the surface of the sun, and around that, especially in the lower corona, you're able to see these coronal loops, and often these flares occur around these coronal loops. And when it flares, the the radiation that's emitted, when you see it, it means it hit you. So if there is an X-class solar flare that produces X-rays, and in some cases higher energies, it can even go to gamma rays, and that can be very dangerous, especially to astronauts in space, it's already hit you. So the thing is, it's always going to be aimed at you if you can see it. Coronal mass ejections, on the other hand, the SDO isn't quite. I mean, it can get a picture as to if a massive magnetic field line has erupted, and it can understand generally which direction it goes in. But then you kind of refer to other missions that look a little bit further out into space. So it basically makes the sun a bit smaller and expands the field of view. So you can actually see if this bubble's expanding. And say if the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, which is actually a 20-year-old mission, which is sitting between us and the sun, it uses its LASGO instrument, and it can see this expanding halo, and it's called a halo. And if you can see this halo expand around the sun, that means it's coming at you. Otherwise, you'll see it come out the side like a bubble, and that means it missed us. But if you see this halo and it looks quite fuzzy and it doesn't look that dangerous, but if you see that, you know, so the physicists are saying, okay, this is coming our way. So there's other missions, and this is why you need many, many different missions, because they're very, very specialized. Each one's very, very specialized, looking at a different component of the temperature of the atmosphere of the sun, or the surface of the sun, or looking at the magnetic structure of the sun. And others are looking further out into the solar atmosphere, the corona. Others are looking into the solar wind. So if you can get this broader picture, you're able to, it's almost like putting pins on a map. You know, one pin on a map won't tell you an awful lot, right, apart from a location. Whereas when you put another pin on the map, you've got a direction. So the more missions you have, the more pins you can put on this map, and the better you can track these coronal mass ejections. But the SDO itself, it's a very focused, very close in view of the sun, and it does have some instrumentation that's able to see a wider picture. But I think to actually define which direction these CMEs are going, you need more than one mission to be, you know, constantly looking at the sun. And also, it's really cool to have two missions that work in tandem. There's currently one mission called STEREO that there's two probes, and they've gone in opposite directions around the sun in Earth orbit. So the path that the Earth takes around the sun, these probes, one's gone off in front of the Earth, the other one's gone behind the Earth, and they're currently traveling around the back of the sun. And you're having these two missions, so it's almost like a stereo vision, and they can watch these coronal mass ejections being generated, and from a 3D construct of this massive bubble, you're able to see which direction it goes in. And that's a really cool mission to do that. But, you know, right, more eyes the better, basically.
Yeah. Now, the CME that flared up August the 1st, it took 3 days to get to us. Is that about a normal, would that be a normal amount of time from when we noticed the ejection? Would that be about, or could it travel faster?
They can travel faster. Oh, yeah. And the bigger and the more energetic the event, the faster the particles and the faster the magnetic field is flung out from the sun. So if you have a very big eruption, you expect the CMEs to travel a lot faster. And in the case of what I was saying, the Carrington event, which happened 150 years ago, I mean, that was measured by very, very rudimentary astronomy. And that was actually tracked. The eruption actually happened on the surface of the sun. It was seen in white light. So this solar flare that occurred on the surface of the sun was so powerful, you could see it in visible wavelengths, which was incredible. I mean, it's kind of unprecedented. We've seen very, very big flares in the past, certainly in the last solar cycle, and we'll see them again. But this one was very big, and it had a very, very powerful, I mean, this was just a massive eruption on the surface of the sun, and it produced a very energetic CME. And literally the day after, it took a day to travel that massive distance. And that was a very, very fast coronal mass ejection. So generally, you know, now, it depends on the conditions on the surface of the sun, but yeah, they can be very right, different in how fast they get here.
Now, if that type of hit came to the Earth in today's society, what would be left? Would it be all of our electronics that would be gone, do you think, or would there be limited outages? How would that affect us, do you think, if that size of ejection happened on the Earth today?
Yeah, I mean, this is where it's kind of exciting and also kind of scary because, well, as I say, when on Discovery Channel when we did this 2012 documentary, we were kind of asked by the producer to whittle down which 2012 doomsday scenario could be likely, and most of them are garbage. Most of the ideas about the end of the world are garbage, but the one that always crops up is the solar flare or a killer solar flare. The sun can't produce a solar flare that's going to blow torch Earth. There's no way, otherwise life wouldn't have evolved on Earth. But in current society, and even since the last solar cycle, since the last solar maximum, we've become even more technologically dependent. And we live in the environment of the sun. So the sun dominates how we use these electronics and how we use this technology. So we have a lot more satellites in orbit. And because we're not able to shield them sufficiently, because the more shielding you put on a satellite, the more expensive it's going to be to put into space, they become more vulnerable. And so when they do get hit by these highly energetic particles coming from the sun, they can get fried and they can die. And recently a communication satellite was knocked out, and that was an interesting story in itself because it actually could have interfered with the Lost season finale, so it actually made headline news. Yeah, I know, the end of the world for a lot of people. But yeah. It didn't actually, in the end, I don't think there was any interruption in cable service. But when you actually have it affecting your daily life, suddenly everybody's very interested in what the sun can do. And if a big one did hit us, I'd say the most vulnerable things are going to be the satellites in orbit because they're not prepared for a massive onslaught of being drenched by these highly energetic particles. And secondary to that, you're going to have these highly energetic particles coming in through the polar caps. They're going to produce electric currents running through the ionosphere and the rest of the atmosphere. And this, in turn, generates magnetic currents in the atmosphere, which can overload, which can basically act like a dynamo and charge up national grids. I mean, it's the Carrington event back in 150 years ago could make the most basic communication systems spark and catch fire and break down. And these are telegraph poles. I mean, these are just telegraph cables, very rudimentary. If they can spark and catch fire, I just wonder what's going to happen now. I mean, people keep on saying there's a lot of fail safes in place. You know, it's going to be very localized damage. But if you have a global event like this, I just wonder if we are prepared. And to be honest, I don't think we'll know until that happens. And another critical problem that we have is, and this was actually brought up again in that documentary, Alex Young mentioned it, and he was saying that national power grids, they don't have many backups. And the big generators and the big subsystems that they have custom built, there's no backups because these things last for decades. Mm. So what happens if these things fry? I mean, what happens if they go down? You're going to have to start from scratch because you don't think about building a backup system that probably costs tens of millions of dollars to build. So there needs to be an understanding about how the sun could influence us on Earth. And until we have that kind of study being done, I don't think we can really fully be prepared for the damage that can be done, because it could be a global catastrophe if we did get hit by another Carrington flare. I mean, coronal mass ejection, but there's no way of knowing. I mean, at the moment, we can't predict the sun's behavior at the moment. We can't say if it's going to happen in this cycle, the next cycle. It could happen in 100 years. It could happen in 1,000. There's no way of knowing. So I just think it's better to be prepared than not, really.
Yeah, I'm very, very surprised with mankind in general that we have put all of our eggs in one basket without electricity. Regardless of how rudimentary your equipment is, without electricity, you have nothing. You have no industry, you have no production, you have no communications. It's all gone. And people don't understand how volatile the magnetic and electrical grids are around the world.
No, absolutely not. And it's a bit like earthquake protection. You know, I mean, So I live near LA, so of course we're probably overdue for a big earthquake, and we've got rudimentary preparation in place. We know what to do in the event of an earthquake. We've got an emergency kit in case, you know, we lose power or, you know, the transportation network collapses. I mean, admittedly, I don't think we're prepared, you know, at all in California for another big earthquake, and we just got to suck it up when the next quake happens, and it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, it is very localized. So even if, you know, half of California was hit by a big earthquake, you'd have the rest of the United States to help out. In the case of a coronal mass ejection solar flare, if you have a very big solar storm, it could knock out an entire nation. And if that happens, you don't have an infrastructure. So what do you do? Where do you get help? How do you communicate to say, you know, we need help? I mean, what happens then? Yeah. And to be honest, your imagination could go wild. You could say it could be a doomsday scenario, but this is another problem that we're probably going to talk about. Is I'm talking about, you know, predicting space weather, and people interpret that as being the next big doomsday event, and of course that's going to be 2012. Right. That is complete rubbish, because there's no way we can predict the moods of the sun, let alone in 2 years' time. I can't tell you what the sun's going to be like in 2 years' time. Nobody can. This is not something you can predict that far in advance.
Right. Now, we know that the sun goes into cycles, and we can pretty well guesstimate when those cycles start up and slow down. From those cycles, could we not extrapolate what would be happening around about 2012?
Yeah, we have an idea, and in fact, very early on, NASA, this was probably about 2 or 3 years ago, NASA issued a press release saying that calculations suggest that the sun is going to have an above average solar maximum, even bigger than the last one. And of course, the last one, it was the most exciting time in my academic life, because I was studying the sun, and we had record breaking X class solar flares and coronal mass ejections by the dozen. It was an amazing time to be a solar physicist. So when NASA issued this release, it was like, wow, you know, there's going to be fireworks around about 2012. This was probably 2 years ago. That was about 2 years ago, the press release. And since then, of course, we have this very, very deep solar minimum, and that was unexpected. So then NASA went back to the drawing board and extrapolated what's happened in the past and what can happen in the future, and they pull back on that, and then they completely went a U-turn and said, actually, it's going to be below average. You know, it's going to be a very uneventful solar maximum. And then we get treated to all this magnetic activity on the surface of the sun, just in the build-up to the solar maximum. So to be honest, we can extrapolate an average, perhaps, of the next cycle as we're actually in it. But we certainly can't say what's solar cycle 25. We're going into 24. We're in 24 now. We can't say what 25, 26, 27 is going to be. It's just you can look at trends and you can get a general idea. But to be honest, that's not going to be an accurate predictor for the sun. And I don't think we're ever going to really get that in advance. We can just work out an average trend, and I think that's all we can really do.
Yeah, makes sense. Question out of our virtual studio. Ian, do you think solar activity can affect global warming?
Solar, there is an effect. It's this is one thing that always comes up whenever I write an article about the sun, whenever I write about its influence on the Earth. And during a solar cycle, there is an increase in output of ultraviolet light. And that's known. It can range by 20-25%. The light stays fairly stable. I mean, the radiation you actually receive if you went out on a hot day and you looked at the sun, there would be absolutely no noticeable difference between the brightness of the sun in the winter as it is in the summer, or at the peak of the solar cycle, or at the minimum. And there's, of course, the sun dominates. So that is that's the energy input into our atmosphere. But it doesn't influence the climate that much. The one thing that is influencing the climate is our output of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. That's what's causing the recent amplification of the greenhouse effect. The sun has very little influence, especially over the timescales we're talking about. We're talking over the last 50 years, we've noticed a massive increase in global temperatures. And the sun's just been doing its thing. It hasn't really changed that much. And yeah, as I say, it waxes and wanes in activity, but that isn't really the main influencer here. The main influencer is we're putting this carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, and that's a highly efficient greenhouse gas. And I'd be stupid if I said that the sun doesn't have any effect on our atmosphere, because that is the only source of energy for our atmosphere. But it doesn't change that much to cause this amount of warming.
Exactly. The sun isn't heating up, and it's not sending flares that are heating up the Earth's atmosphere. That is not what is causing our weather change.
Absolutely not. In fact, there was a very, very interesting article that I wrote, and there was this one astronomy site that linked the recent coronal mass ejection, the one we were just talking about, early August, with the forest fires outside of Moscow. They got their timeline totally wrong anyway, so it was completely void. But the sun doesn't work like that. It doesn't amplify for very, very local areas. It can't amplify the heat in the atmosphere. It doesn't blowtorch the atmosphere. That's not what's going on here. In fact, the gas that's fired at us is very tenuous. It's very, very thin. The solar plasma that actually enters our atmosphere, it's just over a very large area. So it doesn't blow towards the surface. It certainly can't cause forest fires, not directly anyway. But no, it can't have that kind of heating on the atmosphere. It's completely the wrong mechanism.
So could one of these solar flares ignite Earth's atmosphere?
No. No, our sun isn't built like that. If it could, I would argue that there would be no life left on Earth. So how would we evolve? How would we be here? Our sun is people always say it's an average star, and it is. If you compare it to the other stars that are out there, but we're also extremely lucky that it's a very stable yellow dwarf star. We're very, very lucky. It's in the middle of its life. It's a very happy star. It's doing its thing. It's certainly not erupting by any means. The only time that the sun will ignite the surface of the Earth will be in about 5 billion years time, when it runs out of fuel and it balloons up into a red giant, and it will actually swallow the Earth. So quite an interesting thing. I was debating this the other day with a friend, that when we're dead and gone, we will eventually be swallowed by the sun. So even though we get buried on here on Earth, and you know, our ashes or whatever are going to be continued on this planet, we will eventually go into the sun. The sun will swallow us. So we will eventually end up in the sun, which I found quite sobering.
And we will become what we started to be, probably.
We become stardust all over again.
The cycle of life. Tell you what, we're going to take a 2-minute here, Ian, and allow everybody to refresh before we head into the final 20. So just kick back, and we'll be back.
Nikola Tesla single-handedly changed the world for the benefit of mankind, yet has been rewarded with obscurity. It's time to bring his story out of the shadows and into the light. With his last breath, Nikola gently smiled.
Let the future tell the truth and evaluate each one according to his work and accomplishments. The present is theirs. The future, for which I have really worked, is mine.
Would they only have listened?
Nikola Tesla, an upcoming show in the Night Zone. Watch for the listings on blogtalkradio.com.
Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone.
The ancient Sumerian text, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden.
Phone lines are now open. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. I'm gonna send it out to the pit.
following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered. We remind all of our listeners, KV at MTOR. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
In the shadows of the Night Zone tonight.
Zone of Flares and the Universe. Tonight in the Night Zone with Dr. Ian O'Neill.
And indeed, with Dr. Ian O'Neill tonight, making his return engagement after several years being busy putting his life and marriage together. Congratulations on that, Ian. A couple of questions coming out of the virtual studio, Ian. First of all, how are sunspots connected or associated with solar flares? Are they connected?
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I love sunspots. They're very, very complex, dynamic features on the surface of the sun. And the way they're connected is, if you imagine the sun is a ball of plasma, so all intents and purposes a very fluid sphere. And from north to south, you'd normally have these straight magnetic field lines, almost like a bar magnet. You know, it's undisturbed. They go from north to south. It can, as you'd expect, it's completely normal. These field lines run through this plasma. And with the sun, a very interesting thing, by the way, because the reason why you have these solar cycles is because the equator of the sun moves faster than the poles, so it actually rotates faster at the equator. And what happens then, these magnetic field lines are dragged around the equator. And when you have that, you get a lot of a rubber band, yeah, that's the perfect, that's the analogy that I usually use. I mean, it is basically a rubber band that's being stretched and pulled around this sphere. So you can imagine at the end of the 11-year solar cycle, you've got this very tense, very coiled magnetic field that's stretched all the way around the sun. And when you get that, it's almost like, a rubber tube. If you keep on twisting it, eventually it kinks. It produces this loop. And this is exactly what happens with these magnetic field lines. They start producing loops. And because magnetic field lines are very buoyant within the solar body, they float towards the surface and they force out of the photosphere. And what happens then is these magnetic field lines are pushing apart the upper layers of the solar surface. And then, from our point of view, if you're looking at the sun, you start seeing these dark spots form. Now, these spots are actually these locations where you get a collection of these magnetic field lines forcing through the surface and pulling it apart. And the sun, another great phenomenon with the sun, in fact, this is exactly what I was researching back in, it's probably over 5 years ago now, when I was researching that, there's a phenomenon called coronal heating. For some reason, the atmosphere of the sun is actually hotter than the surface and the interior. So it's almost like putting your hand next to a light bulb, and the air surrounding the light bulb is actually hotter than the surface. Now, that doesn't make any sense in normal life, but because the sun is a very magnetically dominated body, there's some complex physics going on with the magnetic fields interacting with waves, interacting with the plasma in the atmosphere that causes this heating. So basically, when you look at the sun and you see these dark spots, it's because you're seeing the hotter upper layers being pulled away, and you're seeing the darker, cooler interior of the sun being exposed. So like pores, they're like little holes in the sun, and these sunspots are actually very bright. But the comparison between the sunspot and the surface of the sun is very contrasting, because of course the sun's very bright. If you have any variance in temperature, certainly if it drops by several tens of thousands of degrees, sometimes millions of degrees, into the interior, it looks black, and that's what a sunspot is. And it's purely formed just by magnetic activity on the sun, and that's why you get more sunspots as the solar cycle progresses, because that's as the magnetic field lines get more and more stressed. So that's how they're connected, basically. That you're basically looking at the portions of the surface being pulled apart by these magnetic field lines being popping through the surface of the sun.
Impressive. So what can power companies do and cable companies do to protect themselves against a massive CME? Are there functions that we can do today that would protect that?
Yeah, I think so. There's some very basic ideas. I mean, of course, this is all is in its infancy, but the idea is if we see a massive, so if we can predict a massive solar storm, power companies, national power grids can be notified that there could be a surge in, there could be an energy spike in their system if this, if a solar storm does erupt and produces this massive current through the atmosphere. And if that happens, or if we are pretty sure it's going to happen, they can actually lower the power, if you like, because they've got the ability to regulate how much power is flooding through the grid at any one time. I mean, there's a famous example in the UK whenever. I think it's one of our soap operas. I think it's EastEnders. Whenever that soap opera finishes in the evening, suddenly there's a spike on the power grid because everybody goes into the kitchen and turns on the kettle. And that is actually, they measure this and they have to deal with it because, you know, you'd be overloaded by kettles. This is certainly a problem, a few years ago, but, you know, now it's a bit more robust. But they do have the power to turn down the energy or turn it up if needs be, if demand requires it. So if there is an onset of the solar storm, and warnings are sent to national power grids, and I'm sure this is how they deal with it. If there is an onset of the solar storm, they probably would bring down the juice a bit to cope with this extra load that they expect. And this is the kind of preparation that we need. This is why we need accurate forecasting.
Right. Now, that, of course, by bringing down the load may help one thing, but would electronics, just in the general population, in people's houses, would that not be affected by a particle release of some kind?
Possibly, but of course, I suppose if you had, if your power grid was, the national power grid was hit by a surge of power, perhaps if you don't have surge protectors on your computers, it could fry some components. But to be honest, I think before that happened, the power grid would go down. It's not like a lightning strike. I mean, it's a bit, I suppose the way to prepare on a national level, the way to prepare for, to take the grid almost offline when you have this massive surge of power going through the system. It's a bit like pulling, it's a bit like unplugging your computer from the wall when there's an electrical storm overhead. So it's a similar kind of thing, but just on a national level. But to be honest, I don't think if we had a massive solar storm that we'd have, you know, your computer catching on fire in your office. That's not to say that fires wouldn't be caused, because there could be like sparking or whatever on power lines, perhaps in arid regions, perhaps going through forests, where fires could start, secondary fires, not caused directly by the coronal mass ejection, but certainly by sparking caused by the increase of load that's on the power lines. I mean, I don't know what kind of fail-safes are in place, but that's certainly something to consider.
Right. Now, it would seem to me then, going back to our basic premise of tonight, is that we need to get a better pre-warning system in place. We need more satellites or more observatories on this issue. Now, not only just for that, but also meteorites. I mean, we've had a couple of close misses in the last little while, and we've had a couple of them come in, one in Canada. So, you know, I understand that there are discussions underway about some organization around the world to monitor incoming and coronal mass ejections. But that's going to take years to put together, I would think.
Yeah, there is a infrastructure there. I mean, at the moment, we do have a lot of agencies working on space weather prediction. I mean, we have NOAA, we've got NASA, you've got other agencies that are funding these things. But the argument that I would use, and again, going back to my friend Alex Young, he was saying that, you know, big companies that have all these satellites in orbit use the free information that comes from these government services. And these government services are naturally underfunded. Surely, the massive armada of satellites in Earth orbit are worth billions to these companies. Shouldn't they be paying their way? Shouldn't they be plowing a lot of money into these space weather prediction systems and also, you know, these observatories? Perhaps we can see more partnerships. I mean, obviously, industry does help out in certain ways. They do fund certain research, but they're not of a global significance in a way. So if we could see like a government agency that almost had a subscription-based service where big communication companies would pay for their service, I'm sure we'd see the service getting a lot better. So there's certain things to consider, and I just think that we can do a lot better. I mean, it's the same as you're saying with asteroid detection. It's a very laid-back affair at the moment. There's brilliant groups out there constantly looking in the skies. There's asteroid detection networks all over the globe, but we're talking about hundreds of astronomers who are involved, hundreds, you know, safeguarding an entire planet. That to me strikes me as a little bit insignificant, especially with the threat. And again, it's a threat. We can't put a time on it. We can't say, okay, we're going to get hit by an asteroid by the next term that the president's in office. And of course, it's all driven by politics. Right. So if a politician, you know, talks to a scientist and he says, well, is it going to happen anytime soon? Well, it could happen today or it could happen in 100 years. That's not something that really ignites the imagination of politicians, and that's where the money really comes from. So yeah. It's hard to change human mentality, and unfortunately, politics is usually the thing that gets in the way.
And it does, and that's the unfortunate part about it. It's all about money. You know, we could do the most amazing investigation scientifically on a number of things if there was just not that money bridge. And all comes back to money, doesn't it? You know, and it's unfortunate. So scientists are finding new planets out there. There's a lot of excitement on your site. There was a lot of excitement about the new pulsating X-ray neutron stars and all kinds of good stuff being found out about with scientists lately.
Oh, yeah, I just wish the universe would give it a break, because every single day I'm waking up to so much news, and it's all phenomenal stuff. I mean, I can't get my head around some of it, and unfortunately, Discovery News, we've got so many great, talented writers that take this on, and I'm just kind of shepherding, you know, overseeing, but they pretty much, you know, pick up the stories they see fit. But as you're saying, yeah, there's been some phenomenal exoplanet discoveries. Today was an analog for another solar system where they detected 7 planets orbiting the same star. Of course, there's 8 planets plus Pluto orbiting our sun, so it's very close to a solar system. I mean, it's a bit of an extreme place. It is a sun-like star, but a lot of these planets are orbiting very, very close to the star, so you can't go guessing about, you know, having a second Earth out there. But it's certainly very exciting. The stuff we are understanding at the moment is incredible. And some of the research actually has been done recently into studying the magnetic field and the magnetic structure of other stars. So we're actually looking at solar cycles occurring on other stars. And I find that's mind-blowing to me. I mean, understanding our solar cycle is one thing, but measuring the solar cycle of a star that's 10 to 100 light years away, I mean, these guys, they've really got it sorted. It makes my job easy because I just, you know, I don't really have to put a lot of work into writing the article. It kind of writes itself. But, phenomenal job and phenomenal science.
Yeah, as we're heading into the final 4 or 3 minutes or so, let me ask you this. There's been a lot of buzz out just lately that there's some gravitational pulls happening in the universe that can only be explained by a brown dwarf or that famous Planet X. Anything out there, Ian, as a scientist, that you can question on this matter? I ask for your honesty because you know the Planet X theories and the whole game plan of that. Is there anything out there that gives us a question as to the possibility of its existence?
No. I mean, the thing is, you've got to remember, a brown dwarf is a very, very big object. I mean, it's hundreds of, I think it's 80 times, about 100 times the mass of Jupiter. And Jupiter is basically the shepherding planet of our entire solar system. I mean, that basically, the gravitational dominance of Jupiter is so strong that it actually vacuums up a lot of space debris, you know, all the leftovers from the development of the solar system. So we've seen quite a lot of flashes actually on Jupiter recently where it's been sucking in these asteroids and comets. And it's so it's got such a dominating power over the solar system that I find it very hard to believe there's anything bigger out there. And there's certainly no evidence by looking at the other planets. Some people will point at Neptune, that there's been some perturbations in its orbit. It hasn't. There is absolutely no published data, and certainly no scientists that have ever come forward saying that something is tugging on Neptune. There could be smaller dwarf planets out there, certainly around the orbit of Pluto that we haven't discovered yet, perhaps. Certainly scattered objects further out from Pluto. I'm sure there are some small rocky bodies out there. I mean, like Eris was discovered only 5 years ago by Mike Brown. In fact, I met him. He's the guy that effectively demoted Pluto, because it turned out that Eris was a little bit bigger than Pluto. So, you know, that whole debate. But nothing bigger. And the thing is, you've got to remember, this is a very big object. So you'd be able to see it. Amateur astronomers would be able to go out into their backyard and spot this thing. Unless it was coming at us from directly below, but we've got a lot of instrumentation on the South Pole. If it was coming directly from above the planet, you know, you've got a lot of observatories on the North Pole as well. And you'd have to ask, why is it coming from up there anyway? Because all the planets are pretty much compressed this one disk that goes around the sun in a similar direction. So no, there's no evidence. And there was actually a study recently that was looking into the feasibility of perhaps a Nemesis or a Planet X being out there. And they can, with a very high degree of confidence, they can say that there is nothing there. There is absolutely nothing of that size. Even it couldn't even conceivably be there. I mean, even Nemesis, which is supposed to be the second sun of the sun, like the sibling sun, it would probably have detached orbit from the sun billions of years ago, because the gravitational attraction would have been so weak. There's just nothing out there. Observatories have been looking, scouring the skies. We're looking very hard for Kuiper Belt objects. So these guys are really, really know what to look for. And there really is nothing there. And I've tried so hard. I've tried very hard to find this thing, but there's no evidence to suggest it's there.
Exactly. And we all want the truth. I mean, that's what it's all about. We're all looking for that truth. And I do appreciate you being with me tonight, Ian. It's been an absolute pleasure. I hope you have lots more good things coming your way, my friend.
Oh, thank you, Colin. It's great to be back.
It's good to have you. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ian O'Neill, solar physicist. And I got to tell you, it's always a pleasure having Ian on the show. He always brings those magical pieces of information that other people just are not prepared to put out there on the table. And go to astroengines.com. That's Ian's website. And from there, you can jump off to the Discovery Network because he is a producer over there. So that's it. That's all. An absolute fabulous show once again. Compliments of the Night Zone, but thanks to you, the audience, for some great questions, and of course, Dr. Ian O'Neill. It just doesn't get any better. Until next week, we'll catch you again. You all be safe out there, and blessings on your household.
Hey, Night Zoners, got a minute? I'm sure we all know someone who is experiencing difficult times during this recession, either with unemployment or financial problems, or in relationships. I have friends like that. I would like to remind you that we are all in this together. So if you have friends experiencing hardships, support them with your advice. If you have acquaintances who are having rough times, nurture them with your friendship. Show them kindness. If you have family members who are having difficulties, show them your love. And if you have people in your life who have almost given up, throw them a lifeline of kindness. Remember the golden rule, but for the grace of God, go I. Blessings upon your household. Until then, next time we meet.
This has been a Night Zone production in association with BlogTalkRadio.com.